All right. So thanks, everyone, for coming tonight. What an opportunity we have here this evening to have a conversation and discussion between these three. So I'm going to introduce them, but I also wanted to just give you a heads up. We did hand out those little cue cards to write down questions, and Mike is going to be collecting those at about 8 o'clock. I'll give a reminder then so that he can compile some of the questions. But we also want to have an opportunity to take questions live from the audience, too. So that's what we've decided to do tonight. So there'll be about, hopefully, half an hour of Q&A at the end. So I'm just going to introduce these three in order of when I met them, actually. So Bruce Alexander, over here, I met him at SFU, and he's actually, that's where he started his exploration of the addiction field back in 1970, and he has counseled deeply entrenched addicts in Vancouver, advocated for methadone and stimulant maintenance treatment, conducted well-known pharmacological research, many of you know about the Rat Park experiments, written on Canadian drug law and drug policy, documented the behavioral addictions of university students, conducted field research on cocaine use for the World Health Organization, studied native issues at the Quatcha and other reserves, and served on the boards of both the Portland Hotel Society and the Vancouver Community Arts Council. Since becoming professor emeritus in 2005, he has conducted neighborhood addiction seminars in Vancouver. And in 2007, he won SFU's Sterling Prize for Controversy. And Bruce has published two books on addiction, Peaceful Measures, Canada's Way of the War on Drugs, and The Globalization of Addiction, a Study of the Poverty in Spirit. And he also has a newest book coming out, written with Kurt Shelton, and it's A History of Psychology in Western Civilization. So thanks for coming here. And I met Gabor next when I worked in the Downtown East Side on the same teams with some of the same clients. And yeah, it was a real honor. And many of you know that Gabor is a renowned speaker and best-selling author and highly sought after for his expertise on a range of topics from addiction to mind-body wellness. And rather than offering quick solutions to these complex issues, Dr. Mathieu weaves together scientific research, case studies, and his own insights and expertise to present a broad perspective that enlightens and empowers people to promote their own healing and that of those around them. As an author, Dr. Mathieu has written several best-selling books, including the award-winning In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, Close Encounters with Addiction, and his works have been published internationally in 20 languages. Dr. Mathieu has received the Hubert Evans Prize for Literary Nonfiction, an honorary law degree from the University of North British Columbia, an outstanding alumnus award from Simon Fraser University, and the 2012 Martin Luther King Humanitarian Award for Mothers Against Teen Violence. And he's an adjunct professor in the Faculty of Criminology at SFU. So thank you for coming.
God, it's getting longer and longer every year.
Yeah, and this was your short bio. And Alfred, I met in 2009 when I started the existential program. And so he was born in Austria in 1951, studied medicine and psychology in the universities of Innsbruck, Rome, Toulouse, and Vienna. After years of hospital work in general medicine and psychiatry, he started a private practice in psychotherapy in Vienna. At the same time, he began a close collaboration with Viktor Frankl. Many of you may know who that is. He wrote Man's Search for Meaning. And he is the founder and president since 1983 of the International Society for Logotherapy and Existential Analysis. And he is a constant lecturer at the University of Mendoza and professor in the universities of Vienna, Sigmund Freud University and Moscow, and an honorary professor in 5 universities. So we have some real experts on addiction here this evening. And so the board and I, we came up with 4 questions that we wanted to ask, and I don't know whether we'll get through them all, because what we were hoping for tonight is more of a conversation and a discussion than anything else. So, but I'll start it off with the first question. So, why don't we just start with Alfred, and we'll go this way to start, and then we'll just open it up after that. Sound good?
I don't know. Maybe.
Is that okay? I'm just going from...
Maybe we start with the best-selling authors.
No, we will start with you. And
okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
So we can increase.
Yeah, sure. So in your view, Alfred, and everyone here, how does addiction take root in a person? What causes it, do you think? What are the inner and outer causes?
Yeah. The cause of addiction is humanity. That we are human. That we feel attracted by values, that we have drives, that we have instinctual behavior, and everyone knows addictive behavior more or less. It forms part of our daily life. We are attracted by a movie, by a book, by a person, by chocolate, by even molting the skin, we can stop it sometimes, and there are terrible little things which attract us and capture us, and it makes it difficult to let it go. And when we experience such attractions, we have a basic feeling like, this is good, this is relieving, this is I'm enjoying it, it gives pleasure, and so, and this is the human basis in our view of addiction. So that means that everybody is prone to addictive behavior, has a disposition to it. It doesn't mean that we are all addicts, but human being can become addictive. And the addiction itself grows out from this combination of a strong, intensive feeling of attraction, in which is concluded a feeling of this is pure life. When I taste it, when I am in contact with an object or with a behavior, then it is that. In there is lust for life, I experience lust of life, and at the same time a relief from dullness, of a relief from a lack of pleasure. It is less pain, life becomes easier, and it is filled up with a deep experience of, which is irresistible almost, of lust for life. So this happens despite of cognitions. We may not agree to what we do cognitively, nevertheless, and we may even reject it, and nevertheless we feel that attraction. This means that somebody else becomes active in addiction. Somebody else moves us. This is the basis for this development is a psychodynamic experience, a psychodynamic power, a psychodynamic feeling that we are lacking of something, that we had not enough relation to pleasurable life, to valuable life. And so out of this lack, which is the germ bud or the sprout of addiction, out of this lack of experience, addiction can arise. Something is sick when we are addictive. What is it what is sick? We can say our will is sick. Our will cannot follow that what we experience or think or sense as being meaningful, valuable, responsible. And so the satisfaction of the need is overwhelming the responsible will. So addiction arises out from an attractive from an imperative attraction and the experience of an inner deficit. The feeling, the basic feeling in addiction is, if I renounce to it, if I could renounce to it, this would not be life anymore. When I get it, when I have it, this is full pleasurable life. As long as I don't have it, as long as I'm not satisfied. In the moment when I'm satisfied, this vision, this attraction disappears, as we know, but this will be a next question then. So, I'm wondering if you experience it differently.
It's. I can see that this evening is going to be not so much a matter of disagreement as of nuance. And but there is some disagreement as well. Just to about that. I mean, I agree with much of what has been said, but I think there's more to it. Now, let's just give a working definition of addiction. At least that makes sense to me. Addiction is any behavior, substance related or not, that a person craves, finds temporary pleasure or relief in, and continues with it despite negative consequences. So craving, relief, pleasure, negative consequences, persistence of the behavior. All right. So let me ask a question. According to that definition, how many of you here have acknowledged that you've had some addictive behaviors in your life? Okay, we have 80% truth tellers and 20% abject liars. Now, so let me ask some of you who have put your hand up, and I'm not going to ask you what you were addicted to or for how long or when in your life, but just what did it do for you? When I say what did it do for you, what did it give you that at the time you needed or thought you needed? So who's going to say? Yeah, go ahead.
Calming and respite.
Calming and respite from?
Things I think are stressful. Trauma.
Stress and trauma. Okay, so calming and respite from trauma. Anybody else? Yeah?
A way to manage my pain.
A way to manage your pain. Great, thank you. Yeah?
A feeling of belonging in the world.
A feeling of belonging. Great, thank you. Go ahead.
Fulfillment
and distraction. Now we could go on, but just look at these qualities. Relief from pain, a sense of belonging, a way of managing stress, calming, and, you know, these are normal human qualities. In other words, you're not wanting anything that isn't normal for human beings to want. The real issue becomes, why did you lack those qualities in your life? What happened to you that you didn't have peace, that you didn't have a sense of belonging, that you had pain, that you had to soothe, that you had more stress than you could manage? And the sources of that have to do with life experience. It's more than just being a human being. It's also being a human being that suffers. And so the root of addiction is actually in suffering. And now the essence of suffering, of course, as Bruce will tell you very appropriately, is a dislocation, a disconnection from self, from others, from the world, from community. But it's suffering that creates that. And I mean, I used to work in this hospital for many years, and in this hospital we admitted people with HIV and addictions and all manner of problems. And let me tell you, every single one of these people I have admitted to this hospital with HIV and addictions had been traumatized as a child, and every single one of the women had been sexually abused. So we're talking about trauma and abuse in the severe cases of addiction. Milder forms of suffering, if you can talk about suffering, is milder in other cases of suffering. And that then creates that emptiness that Frieda talked about, that sense of insufficiency of the self that then has to be fulfilled from the outside. And I'll give you a quote from an American or Hungarian-born psychiatrist, Hungarian-born physician like myself, Thomas Hora, who said, "The meaning of all addictions can be defined as endeavors at controlling our life experience with the help of external remedies."
with help. So the fact is, as has been said, life becomes so difficult, so painful, that you come to believe that without that external remedy, whether it's sex or gambling or the internet or shopping or food or heroin or cocaine or crystal meth or whatever it happens to be, that without that external remedy, your life is just not livable. Now, that of course has its spiritual aspects and its psychodynamic aspects. It also has physiological aspects, because we now know, and let me tell you, the addictions and physicians in this hospital don't know this. I know they don't know it because I've talked to them a lot. And why they don't know it is a supreme mystery, almost. But the science that shows that the brain itself develops an interaction with the environment, so the circuits of the brain, for example, develop an interaction with the early environment, and the most important aspect of the environment that affects the very physiology of the brain, I'm talking about the chemicals and the circuitry of the brain, is actually the mutual responsiveness of adult-child relationships in the early years. So when those relationships are missing or lacking or stressed or traumatizing, the very brain circuits don't develop properly. And then you talk about belonging. If you talk about, for example, heroin use, heroin being an opiate, heroin plays off the body's own internal opiate system. It wouldn't work unless we had our own internal opiate system. Those are called endorphins, or endogenous morphine-like substances. And one of the jobs of endorphins, natural endorphins in our body, is to relieve pain. The other is to give us a sense of pleasure and reward. But their most important role is to actually give us a sense of belonging. Now, those kids that have had these experiences where they've been traumatized or cut off from contact, their endorphin system just doesn't develop so well. They're sitting ducks for opiate addiction. So what I'm trying to say is that addiction has its psychological, psychodynamic dimensions for sure. They're huge. They also have its brain physiological dimension, spiritual dimensions, social dimensions, as Bruce points out so articulately, and so on. And finally, when it comes to will, that's a huge issue in addiction, and I've experienced it personally, like when I'm in my addictive cycles, and I have been, I just have no will at all. It feels like I'm totally an automaton. And that's what the meaning of addiction actually is. The word addiction comes from the Latin word addictus, for a slave. And it is a slavery in the sense that free will does not seem to exist. Now, I know that your teacher, Viktor Frankl, I'd like to read a quote from him on this subject. He says, really articulately, as he always does, between stimulus and response, there's a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response lies our growth and our freedom. Well, the addict does not have that space between the stimulus and the response. He goes from the one to the other like that. And so the whole issue is, how do we help people develop that space? They can have the freedom where the will can actually show up. And if you do brain scans on drug addicts, the commonest brain finding is abnormality in the part of the brain that regulates impulses. In other words, that stops us from doing something that's not good for us. And as somebody very astutely said, the problem in addiction is not lack of free will, but lack of free won't. There's just nothing to say no with. And that's the dilemma. And then the question becomes, well, how do we help these people? And that's what I'll finish my comments.
Well, Alfred and Gabor, that is very little that hasn't been said.
Sorry.
And it's all been said very, very eloquently. And maybe I can fill in a little bit, however. Yeah, I mean, I should say that my experience starts a long time ago, in the 1970s, in the predecessor to the downtown East Side, working with heroin addicts on the street. And that's really where I got the ideas that I'm still working on. And the essential idea is that, I mean, Alfred said it's humanity, and Gabor expands on that. Really, it's a hole in the humanity. It's a void. It's something terribly important that's missing, and all the depression that goes with that, all the suicidal inclinations which go with that, and it turns out that addiction is kind of magical for filling that kind of void in terms of meaning and purpose and identity. addiction will do that for you. And this is something which I, you know, it took me many years to learn this, working with addicted people, but addiction is working for them. It's for example, I mean, in the most obvious case, right outside the door here, if we go over to the downtown east side, I mean, what we see is people who would really have nothing. They would really not have a life, but they do have a life. They're junkies. And that's not nothing. It's not what your mom and dad wanted you to be, but it's not nothing. It's there is a meaning, there is a purpose, there is an identity, and addiction does that for us. And it isn't just the drug addictions. And this is, of course, the great discovery of the last few years, that all kinds of addictions, it works the same. If you're addicted to trading stocks for hedge funds, it's the same. You're filling the void with the thrill of making money and raping the environment with your activities. And again, maybe your mother and father wouldn't have wanted you to do that, but it's a lot better than nothing. That's what it's about. So the question, as it was put to us, was what's the inner cause and the outer cause? And we've spoken mostly of the inner cause. And so I'd like to turn attention a little bit to the outer cause and say, it is a historical fact that there are eras in history when addiction is quite rare. And there are eras in history when addiction is, when we're drowning in it. And we happen to be in one right now where we're drowning in it. And we have to ask why. What is it about this particular here and now which makes us an addicted society? And that has been the subject of my life's work, is looking at this historically. And what does is that we're in a particular kind of civilization, which we can date back about 500 years, and we can say, well, this particular kind of civilization is uniquely suited for breaking down cultural traditions and religions and ethnicities and languages and expectations that people grow up with. We live in a concrete mixer kind of civilization which breaks everything down, and that's on the political level. But if we ask, well, what does that do to people? Well, that makes them, for one thing, really bad at raising children. If all their traditions, all their bases for security are broken down, well, that transmits itself into child rearing behavior, and it also is not just parents. Of course, we don't want to. I'm a parent. You're probably mostly parents. We don't want to put all the blame on parents, do we? No, it's also teachers and everybody, all the institutions of a cement mixer society don't function right and don't build up the kinds of structures and meaning and purpose and identity that is the essence of humanity. So what's the outer cause? Well, the outer cause is a particular kind of society that we're in right now. That is the outer cause of the great flood of addiction we're dealing with. Of course, it exists in other places as well. But we have to deal with that outer cause. So I think when I want to put the emphasis here on the fact that we not only have to deal with people in their individual struggles and families in their individual struggles, and communities like the Downtown East Side and its individual struggle, well, we have to deal with the struggles of civilization itself, because ours is an addictogenic civilization, if you don't mind the jargon. And I'm hoping that will be part of our discussion tonight, that we do not limit ourselves to simply the individual and the particular, but look at it in a very broad way, because my feeling is that if we do not also look at it in a very broad way, we have no real hope for overcoming this problem. And I'll stop there.
May I ask you what you see as the specific of this civilization, which makes it so pushy towards addictive behavior. Why? What is the core issue that makes this civilization so poison?
In my opinion, which is a perfectly
opinion
conventional
investigation
opinion
that you made.
In my opinion, the core issue is a particular kind of economic structure that we've developed. Yeah. And I don't want to say capitalism. I mean, come on.
Why not?
Because the Cold War is over. We're all capitalists now. What we have to say is there's a particular kind of cowboy capitalism, mad capitalism, which is coming at us from all directions. And we just had the American elections, and if we were to need any further proof, there it is. Yeah, we have an economic system which has been developing for 500 years, and the most wonderful historians, I like Polanyi, Karl Polanyi, for example, the most wonderful political economists and philosophers and historians have shown that it is the very nature of this economic evolution is that it breaks down traditional structures. It must, because the essence of a free market, you see, is that everybody behaves as an individual economic actor. Well, you cannot behave as an individual economic actor unless you have given up your allegiances to your villages and your clans and your guilds and all the rest of it. So I think when we come to the core of it, when we're ready to face the core of it, we will have to face the fact that we have evolved a civilization which has, you know, it's a wonderful civilization. You know, it's a fount of creativity, and there are a million reasons to love it, but it does have some side effects. And we see the side effects in this rising tide of depression and anxiety and addiction, and I think we can trace them all back, ultimately, to this kind of a social reality. And therefore, I think we need to make the field of addiction much more of a historical field than it has been, without giving up the wonderful kind of, you know, personal work that has to be done as well. It all has to be done, but my fear is that we leave the historical portion of it out a little bit.
Well, Bruce's wonderful book, The Globalization of Addiction, just nails it in terms of the broad social issues, and you talk about dislocation, which is the cutting off from self and community and so on. And historically, it's dislocation that feeds addiction on a massive scale, and there's no more poignant and tragic and bitter example of that than our First Nations population here in Canada. I spent Friday at a First Nation reserve in Saskatchewan, 2 hours out of Saskatoon, where they've had, within the last month, 2 suicides and several suicide attempts, where addiction is rife, where abuse is rife, where mental illness is rife, where suicide is always a risk. And this is from a culture that in terms of its own traditions had none of that stuff. It's all because of the dislocation that was perpetrated upon them by colonialism and continues to be. And as far as the broader question, just to illustrate what Bruce has just said, and I'd like to read you a quote from Thomas Merton, who is a monk, a Catholic monk and spiritual adept who died quite young in the early 50s. But he wrote, and he doesn't spare the word capitalism, by the way. He said, "It is true that the materialistic society, the so-called culture that has evolved under the tender mercies of capitalism, has produced what seems to be the ultimate limit of this worldliness. And nowhere, except perhaps in the analogous society of pagan Rome, has there ever been such a flowering of cheap and petty and disgusting lusts and vanities as in the world of capitalism, where there's no evil that is not fostered and encouraged for the sake of making money." And it goes way beyond just the profiteering. It actually comes down to how, you know, we have, I don't know if you're familiar with this beautiful institution in Austria, I hope you're not, called Walmart. But Walmart is this big store, and we think that we're going through just economic changes, but every time Walmart goes up, the addiction rate is guaranteed to go up. Because Walmart destroys communities. Walmart destroys neighborhood stores. People no longer shop in their communities. They no longer talk to their neighbors. There's not that exchange, that human exchange where you go into a store and in Turkey, you can't go into a store and buy something before they ask you how you're doing and very often offer you a cup of tea. And the same thing happens in Provence, in France. You know, you just can't, give me a loaf of bread. They look at you like you're a barbarian. Because you haven't said hello, and you haven't asked what their children are doing today.
But in
our society, because of this economic structure that Bruce talked about, it's not just the profiteering, it's also the breakdown of community, and therefore the breakdown of human contact, which then feeds the emptiness that you were talking about.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to turn it back to
the lack
Alfred,
of relationship, yeah. The lack of closeness, right. Of humanity, exchange of the dislocation, as you mentioned before. Yeah. These are very important issues. Looking at the common denominator of what makes it so poignant for addiction, I don't know what you would say, but there are people also in our community, in our society, in our civilization, who are not addictive, who are not prone for addiction. They live a good, normal life. Not everyone is in danger for addiction in our society. The materialism, the capitalism,
yes,
hits some parts of the population harder than others. And why?
Why? Well, again, I mean, the experience of parents, I think, is the crucial thing, and I, of course, we all feel a lot of parents, I'm sure. But, you know, parents know how difficult it is. Their parents know what it is to watch a child grow up and see that the child might really not be able to put all the pieces together, to see how difficult it is. And then when our children grow up and they make it and they become psychosocially integrated, if I could say, or they get a life together, we're overjoyed. But the one next door didn't, and the one down the block didn't. I think we're in a situation where parenting, which at another stage of civilization would be a relatively easy process, where the child's course would be sort of prearranged and it would be understood where the child was going, and there wouldn't be all this terrible uncertainty. We face the uncertainty, and if we're lucky, we can say that our children have gone through it and grown up and are fine. Thank God, we would have to say, that's what I say about my children, thank God. But it doesn't always work that way. And I think the way that the problem of cultural breakdown and dislocation works is that it gives everybody a handicap, and many people make it in spite of the handicap, but many more don't make it, who would have made it if in a less dislocated society. And my fear is that as we, as we continue to frack and pipeline our way through the 21st century, we may be creating ever more of these kinds of disruptions and dislocations, so that the handicap may grow ever greater.
Yeah, and what is the disruption producing? Disruption produces maybe trauma. This is your theory, that addiction is always based on trauma.
How do you define trauma, by the way?
Trauma, hurting experiences which are not integrated.
Okay, that's great. I agree with that. And I put it another way, trauma is something that is a hurting experience that cuts you off from yourself.
When it's not integrated,
It's not integrated, yeah. So the people that do well are either have been able to somehow integrate their hurt, or they were never hurt that much in the first place.
Yeah.
It's one or the other. And by the way, addiction is not the only... It's not a question that everybody who's traumatized will be addicted.
Yeah.
There are other outcomes to trauma.
Yeah.
There's depression, anxiety, cancer, rheumatoid arthritis, multiple sclerosis, ALS...
Suicide.
Colitis, suicide, schizophrenia. I mean, so trauma has multiple outcomes, addiction is one of them. It's a common one, but it's not the only one. So not everybody who's addicted is not traumatized, but everybody who's addicted was traumatized. Is that how I put it?
I would put it a bit in a broader way. Dislocation, disruption of relationship, of outer relationship, of inner relationship towards oneself, leads to an experience of to a basic feeling, existential feeling of this is no more good life. And all those who live in our society, who experience this society, this materialism or capitalism or communism, I'm very often in Russia. So all those who experience it as not worth living. Yeah. They are prone for addiction. Could you say that?
There's a patient of mine who said to me, I'm not afraid of death, he says, I'm more afraid of living. I'm more afraid of life than of death, he said. And then the question is, well, what happens to people that... And of course, the other part of that, I think, we'll agree on, is that not only are they afraid of living, they can't conceive of another life. There's no perception.
There's
no way out. There's no other way to live this life except either in suffering or in escape from suffering.
Yeah, and then they numb themselves.
And then they numb themselves. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and say, and more. One intention may be numbing the pain, themselves, or escaping in a way the bad situation of life in which they are, but. The other is also the attractive part of addiction is that there is something which looks like being good for the moment.
Yeah.
And therefore it's attractive. And this is something which we really need in our existence, something which attracts us. No, in normal life it's a value, a pleasure or whatever. But in that case, it's an ersatz life. It's a replacement of real life, a virtual life, or an imagination, a hope, a wish.
It's a substitute.
A substitute, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that brings us back, of course, to the eternal issue of disease.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it is my thought that the word disease is sort of misplaced when we're talking about addiction. It is my in the context we've been using it here. If we're talking about normal human beings who are missing something important, and the best way they can find to substitute or to provide some portion of that which they're missing is an addiction, then I would want to say, well, these people aren't sick. These people are adapting in a way that it's not a great way, but that's the nature of adaptation, is that we do the best we can with it.
I agree totally that sickness is a way of adaptation, but it's an insufficient way of adaptation, which is self-harming or harming to others.
Oh, yes. So, it's not satisfactory,
there's actually an article in a medical journal 2 years ago, a Journal of Pediatrics, which is the official journal of the American Pediatric Association, and they say that adaptations that children make early in life to stress or instability help them endure the early stress, but become source of pathology later on. Mm-hmm. In other words, the adaptation, which is meant to be a temporary state, becomes a long-term trait. Mm-hmm. And you can see addiction as a distraction, and distraction can be an adaptation, but if it stays over in the long term, it becomes a state, or a trait, sorry, rather than a temporary state, and then it shows up as pathology. And Bruce, I think your comments about disease are well placed, but what if you hyphenated the word? Addiction is dis-ease.
Yeah.
Rather than disease. Then I think actually you're pointing at the right direction.
Yeah. I'm hoping that we would get to the fourth question. The fourth question that we were given was basically what should be done, but having established this context of a way of looking at addiction where we're really not disagreeing very much, I think we'll find perhaps more room for disagreement.
I'm disagreeing to Gabor.
If you want to make a fool of yourself.
Yeah. But I'm not so self-confident. I try.
We're neighbors. He's from Austria. I'm from Hungary. Yeah. We've been fighting each other for hundreds of years.
No, we have collaborating. We have been collaborating. This was called the Austrian-Hungarian monarchy.
I could go into the history of that.
Okay. No, you disagree. Okay.
I disagree.
You mentioned, you cited Frankl by saying that... Viktor Frankl. You had a citation of Viktor Frankl by saying that between stimulus and response there is
a space,
a gap. The space of where the human being is placed.
Yeah.
And you doubt if that happens in addiction. You put it that way, at least I understood it that way, that stimulus is producing response. In that case, it's a reaction, not a response. A response is an a personal action.
Yeah, I'm saying that.
Yeah. And the idea, and this is, sorry if I step into the second
question. Thank you.
May I?
Yes.
the will plays a role in addiction. Nobody is addictive or steps into addiction against one's will.
Nobody chooses to be an addict either.
Do you
think anybody wakes up in the morning and says, my ambition is to become a drug addict? Does anybody wake up in the morning and say, my ambition is to become a drug addict?
Yeah, sure. So
it's not a will to become an addict.
Yeah. But the tragic of the addictive is that when we are pushed for an addictive behavior, being it playing or drinking or whatever, in the moment we are starting to do it, our will is there. We absolutely want to do it. Nobody drinks even a drop of beer against his will.
Uh-huh. Okay.
We say yes, for the moment I forget everything for the moment. It's the most important for me to have this, to do that.
Yes.
And I call this will. I really want to do it. And in craving, there is a lot of will. On the background, there's a concept of the human being which says that we are always a person, that we are an entity, a unity, which cannot be divided. And even in addictive behavior, even in sick behavior, there is some part of will in it.
So what is
but
what,
there
what,
has so to so make much more some more distinctions. I will come up with them a little.
Define will for me, because I want to understand what you mean by will. Because we may not mean the same thing.
Will is a yes, an affirmation of something which appears to be valuable.
Okay. So Eckhart Tolle, the spiritual teacher, asked the question about how responsible are people when they're unconscious? When something's driven by unconscious forces. So you come from Vienna, you've heard about unconscious, you know what I'm saying? So when people are driven by unconscious forces, formally speaking, you can say that they have a will, but that's the meaning of addiction. It's a slavery where somebody else is in charge. And what I'm saying is there's the conscious will, there's the unconscious will. And in addiction, it's not that, I mean, it's a very fine line. It's a superb discussion now for you, because it's absolutely crucial what you're pointing to. The real issue is, how much will does that person have at that moment? And let me tell you, just from my personal experience, and I never had a substance addiction, so I never went through withdrawal or any of those physiological horrors that addicts face. If you do go through them, let me tell you, there's not a whole lot of will present at that moment. But I didn't do that. I was just addicted to a certain behavior. But let me tell you, when I was caught up in it, I did not experience it, my having as a will at all. I actually didn't want to do it, and then it was just so much easier just to give in. I gave in to something internally.
It's giving in is will.
Yeah. Well, you say that as will. If you want to define it that way, that's fine. But I'm saying it's a giving in to some unconscious drive at that moment that seems more powerful. And that's why when they go to the 12-step groups, the first thing they say is,
I acknowledge my powerlessness over this, you know. And actually, now the real question that you and I might agree on is, how do we help people develop the will in a positive sense? Okay, mm-hmm. In other words, mm-hmm. The addict who experiences himself as powerless against the addictive drive, you don't call that will. I mean, that's your definition. I can't argue with your definition, except it's not my definition of will. My definition of will includes something much more conscious and aware than that. Mm-hmm. And you know, let me put it this way, the obsessive compulsive who has to wash his hands 100 times before he leaves the house, he has to. You can say he's got will and he's willing to wash his hand, but he's not actually. He just doesn't have a choice in the matter. At least he's not in touch with the part of himself that would give him that choice. So I'm saying that only by a certain definition of will I agree with you. A definition of meaningful will, I don't.
Yeah, you're right.
If I could broaden this just a little bit, well, a lot.
Please.
I would like to point out what we all know here, which is that the history of psychology, the question of what we call the free will determinism issue, has been argued in psychology forever. For a couple of thousand years, we have written records of it, and we can be quite sure that they were arguing about it before they started writing it down. Yeah, we've been arguing about it forever, not in the context of addiction, but just in the very broader sense. If we ask, you know, why do I choose to live here rather than there, or why do I fall in love, or why do I have dinner? We can give an answer in very good psychological language, which proves that there is no will whatsoever, that it's all a concatenation of neurons. Or we can give an answer which proves that it must in its essence be will, that nothing else is possible. And we've been doing this for thousands of years with all behaviors, not just addictive behaviors. And my thought is that when we get to the addiction, we somehow raise the question again, but we find it equally intractable when we talk about addiction. We find it sometimes useful to talk, as you have just now, talk about addiction in the terms of the phenomenology of not experiencing will, and sometimes it's useful to talk about it in terms of the experience of knowing that ultimately there is will, and it's a pragmatic matter, I think. It's a matter of being able to look at it this way or that way, and rather than a question that surely we're not going to resolve it tonight. Since it's been 1,000 years in the making, but I think it comes down to the fact that we all have to recognize that an addicted person, you know, has a little more, a little less willpower than the rest of us, but they're human beings, right? We're just understanding them as human beings doing what human beings do, and I think that the question will never be definitively answered.
Well, let me understand a bit more though, Alfred. Like, are you saying that it's a free will that people have? Would you call that free will, or would you just call it will?
This is the distinction.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Will is an agreement. In the will is always contained a yes to something. Mm-hmm. A giving in. When I give in, I say, yes, okay, I do it. This okay, I do it, this consentment, this agreement. And this is the essential of will. But will can be responsible or not responsible. It depends on what the will is referring to. In addiction, I give myself up for the moment. And this is the tragic of the addictive person, that the addictive says yes, wants to do that, what he or she does in that moment, agrees, gives in, but he or she cannot stand behind afterwards. And this is really the tragedy, that I myself bring myself into an activity where I do not find myself again, where I cannot agree, where I step back there. I distance myself afterwards. And this is really a tragedy in addiction, that we are able, in our freedom, we are able to act against us.
So when does will show up in life? Does it one day old baby have will?
Can I just stop for a sec? I just want everybody to, Mike's going to collect the questions so he has time to arrange them. Sorry, thank you.
So does a one-day-old baby have will?
This is such a blossom where you cannot say that it flowers. But in the nucleus, it's there. So
is it there on the second day?
You know, when is the flower open? On the third day or on the fourth day?
Yeah, well,
that's continuous.
I agree with you. I think it's something that has to bloom and develop. But like with any plant, for its development, the conditions have to be right.
Right.
When the conditions are not right, that flower will not develop properly. And neither does free will develop properly. So to talk about free will in the case of many, 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 many people is only true in the abstract. And in real life, many of us don't have free will in the sense that we're governed by unresolved, undeveloped issues in our lives, unintegrated pain, undeveloped brain circuitry.
This is always there.
Yeah, yeah. So
every human being.
So the real question for me in addiction is, how do we then help people gain that freedom? Where the will becomes
that
actually...
is that little yes we say or not.
Okay.
On the basis of all the unresolved and unconscious
issues.
All right,
issues. Well, if that's true, you know, then I know you, I'm sure you don't intend to do this, but theoretically, as far as I read it, you're doing it anyway, which is to justify punishing people. Because if they're making a free choice by will, then why not punish them for it?
Then
why not have the war on drugs? Then why not treat people terribly in jails? I mean, if they're really making a choice.
If the discussion would go in that direction, I would renounce of talking about will in that discussion.
Okay, but that's where it goes. Because the belief, the legal belief, the myth that actually governs this society is that people are choosing to do these things, and therefore they're responsible, and therefore we can hold them to account, and therefore we can punish them. That's the argument.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that ain't true. It's just not how it is.
That's not what I'm saying.
I know
I'm
not
talking about choosing.
You don't like the outcome, but that's the implication of what you're saying.
This is a possible implication which one may intend to how to say to put me under my shoes. Yeah.
Well,
no,
anyway.
But nevertheless, the will has so much freedom that we can act against ourselves. I don't know if you can agree with that.
Well, you see, I really do believe. I really do believe, and I work all the time with the power of the unconscious, and like what we've all identified, for example, all three of us, this emptiness, the sense of insufficiency that the addict, not just the addict, but many human beings experience. Right? Well, the reality is, of course, it's not true. None of us are actually empty, and none of us are insufficient. Okay.
But we can feel it that way.
We can feel it that way. That doesn't make it true. In fact, when people recover, the very word recovery from addiction means when you recover, you find something. What do people find? They find their true selves. They find that they're not empty after all. Like they live 50 years with the belief that they're empty.
But they live differently then.
Sorry?
And they live differently, and therefore they find content.
They may live differently, or they may have a spiritual experience like that. But whatever happens, they're going to experience their fullness. Then they laugh and they say, what a fool I've been. For 50 years I believed I was empty, and I realized actually I'm not empty in that insufficient sense. But as long as they unconsciously believe that they are empty, they're going to be driven by a need to fill that emptiness. And in that space, there's not a whole lot of freedom. There's not a whole lot of will. And again, the question for me in treating addiction is precisely, and I hope we can agree on this, that how do we help people develop that space that Viktor Frankl talked about? How do we help them develop that
moment in which they really can experience themselves as conscious and powerful actors in their own lives. And there's things we can do to help people achieve that. There's things we can do to help people undermine that sense of theirs. So the question is, we help people, and I'm sure you help people, by helping them find their freedom. I'm sure people come to you in a state of non-freedom, and they leave your therapy, if you're successful with them, in a state of relative freedom. I'm sure that happens. If it doesn't happen,
yeah,
we need to find we need to find different work. You know? So the question is, how do we help people magnify their freedom and really identify with their free will rather than their dictated will, dictated by the unconscious?
Yeah, but by seeing the role of the will, even in addiction, this gives us a place where we can enter with therapy.
Okay.
Because between stimulus and reaction, there is a little space. The little space is in giving in. And so we can train the person to give in, let's say, a bit before it is pushing the person. And so doing deliberately, paradoxically, what he or she is going to do anyway in 15 minutes.
I agree with you.
And so we can train this will and make it more and more responsible, more personal. And so this is the reason why we, in the existential view of the addiction, we point to this role of the will this is how I play with addiction and how I make my life tragic, because I continuously experience that I act against myself. Mm-hmm. And this is the hangover afterwards, part of the hangover, part of the chemical
to me, the amazing thing is that you can do that wonderful kind of therapy that you're talking about and actually give people freedom or give them a greater sense of their freedom, and it works for some people. On the other hand, you can do therapy which is based entirely on cognitive behavioral principles which assume no freedom whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And that works for some people. To me, the truly amazing thing is that we have 100 kinds of therapy which cover the whole range from complete emphasis on freedom to no emphasis whatsoever on freedom, and all of them work for some people, but all of them together are not sufficient to bring the problem under control. The therapy itself, I think, has to be called into question, because there are so many brilliant kinds of therapy. And I, as I was saying earlier, I heard your tape from last year. Brilliant kind of therapy that you describe, and yet it and all the other 99 kinds are not going to get us out of the mess. And I would like to ask you two gentlemen, since you're both real therapists and I'm really not, how do we understand that? How do we understand the fact that therapy isn't better than it is?
That's a difficult question. Don't you have another one?
Well, I'm saving the hard one.
I don't know what to say about that one. First of all, in my opinion, much of the therapy of addiction is based on false assumptions. And when you start with false assumptions, you're just not going to get anywhere. I've talked to addiction psychiatrists. I talked to the guy who was the head of the psychiatry department for addictions at CAMH, the Center of Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, when I gave rounds there. And this psychiatrist, with 8 letters after his name, didn't realize that every person he ever saw was a traumatized human being, which is astonishing to me, but he didn't realize it. Well, how can he help anybody if he doesn't see them? Because he was in denial of his own trauma. So a lot of therapists are actually in denial of their own pain. They haven't integrated their own hurt, and therefore they can't help other people. Secondly, the official view of addiction that's perpetrated, I should say, popularized by the American Society of Addiction Medicine, which every addiction physician has to get training in, is that addiction is a primary brain disease. I mean, which is caused 50% by genetics. Now, if you believe that addiction is a primary brain disease that arises in the brain as a disease, which I think we all three of us have disagreements with, and if you think it's all genetically determined at 50%, you can't help anybody because you don't get what it's about. So I'd say that the basic problem is that we as a society, we deny trauma, we deny how hurt people are, and when you come from an ideological basis which denies reality, you can't help people deal with reality, and that's the sad catch of it. And I believe me, I speak to a lot of therapists and psychologists and so on through my travels, and it amazes me how much they, as goodwill as they may have, but from my perspective, how little they actually understand, even about themselves. And I would say, by the way, that ultimately it does come down to the therapist, and I sure would agree, it comes down to what work we've done on ourselves, because anything that we haven't resolved in ourselves, we're bound to be blind about in our clients as well. And I'm sure that in your work, you really have to work, and I don't know, like, you trained as a psychologist, Bruce, which means you got a degree in psychology and you taught it. Was there any requirement that anybody in psychology actually works on themselves at all? To get an academic degree?
Well, in clinical psychology, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but not in the kind that I trained in.
Okay.
Rat psychology.
Yeah. By the way, speaking of rats, I mean, what did your research show but that the rats that were treated well, you couldn't make them into addicts no matter what? And the rest that you mistreated or you confined, they're the ones who are prone to addiction, which goes back to my trauma thesis. I mean, I've never found a better proof for what I have to say than Bruce's rat part experiment, where you had this attractive substance called morphine, and you even sweetened it, and you say that the rats love the sweet taste of it, and you couldn't get it into them unless you confined them and basically tortured them, and then they would go for the pain relief. So which goes back to the role of addiction as a compensation, as a self-soothing, as an adaptation. I think which is what all three of us agree on.
Gabor, thank you. I love to hear you say that. but I would want to go back to that question of why is it that all the therapies together don't do better than they do? Because of course some therapists do recognize trauma.
Yeah,
and but they aren't solving the problem either. So I think the problem remains.
And independently of what concept is the therapy is based on, the effects are more or less the same. As you said before, a pure behaviorist has more or less the same results than we have, let's say, in existential analysis also. And why can this happen? I think a part of this very important distinction you made about the unresolved problems in the therapist and the concepts with which the therapist works. Yeah. The addiction itself is a very complex issue, and it is based on different causes. Trauma is one, or this connection of oneself is one, but it can also be a bipolar disorder, or any psychological disease can be a cause which leads to addiction, as we know.
Well, I totally agree with you. I totally agree. I mean, if you see, this is why I think we have to look at it on multiple levels.
Right.
Like when you actually look at the condition, I've been diagnosed with ADHD. How do we treat it? We treat it with stimulant medications, which elevate dopamine levels in the brain, and dopamine is our incentive motivation chemical. So without enough dopamine, we feel bored. You know, and then now we need dopamine. Well, what gives us dopamine? Any exciting behavior, sex, gambling, shopping, cocaine, crystal meth, nicotine, caffeine. So people are self-medicating lack of dopamine in their brain. They're often self-medicating ADD. They self-medicate anxiety. As you say, they self-medicate bipolar illness with alcohol very often. They self-medicate PTSD with opiates. They self-medicate social phobia with alcohol, marijuana, opiates. They self-medicate depression with chemicals that elevate serotonin levels like cocaine. So, I mean, on one level, I think
whatever we say about addictions, on one level, they're all self-medications for underlying mental health issues.
Yeah, mental health issues, and also psychological issues,
yes.
and stress and problems, etc.
Absolutely.
Problem drinking is a very high percentage of alcoholics, which ease their life with alcohol, and so addiction is a symptom or a syndrome,
yes.
of a multi-causal basis, and many issues, pure somatic, psychosomatic, psychodynamic, personal, relational, political, economical issues come together and produce this unease in life. And the addictive stuff is helping to find a supplement which gives a sort of life, a sort of direction, a sort of issue, of outcome of the difficult situation, which is caused so differently from so many different areas. And therefore, in some part, a pure behavioral therapy is maybe even more effective than a humanistic approach or a psychodynamic approach. And in other parts, it's the reverse. So in the total, in the sum, it is more or less the same issue which comes out independent from the theoretical basis from where the treatment has begun. This is my view to this. A part of the difficulties which is in the therapist, which are in the therapists themselves.
And I think I would only add that the research that I've seen on whether the therapy is successful or not comes down in the end not to the intellectual position or school of therapy, but the quality of the therapeutic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And whether it's a healing relationship, whether it's a safe relationship, when there's safety, that actually opens up space in people's minds.
I mean, it's
not the only factor, but I think it's the most significant one. Personally, I think that's the most significant one.
Yeah.
And, you know...
But it's also very important that we get trained people in, as you put before, in dealing with suffering. Suffering is something substantial in the human life. And addictive people are not ready to keep on with their suffering, to continue, or they avoid suffering by many reasons. But the avoidance of confronting problems which meet for a certain time, there is some suffering when we have to confront the problem with our partner or with our children. It's easier to avoid it. And addictive people avoid reality to a high degree because reality may produce suffering, pain. Or addictive people has to learn to live with more self-acceptance in the sense of their problematic life, their neediness, their weakness, which belongs to one's life. The damped-up neediness is like a tinder for addiction.
You know what, there's a quote I'm looking for, but it seems like I'm not finding it, but it's from the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying.
While you're looking.
No, but I don't need to look. It's fine. I'm not in fact, I found it. This is from the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, and I think ultimately the field of addiction has to be not to get people out of pain, because you can't do that, but to help them live with their pain. So this is the Tibetan monk who wrote the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying. He says, whatever you do, don't shut off your pain. Accept your pain and remain vulnerable. However desperate you become, accept your pain as it is, because it is trying, in fact, to hand you a precious gift, the chance of discovery through spiritual practice, what lies behind sorrow. So I think, ultimately, it's not a matter of getting people out of pain, and
right.
The medical profession is largely addicted to trying to get people out of pain, rather than helping people endure their pain. And
We don't have to cause people pain. Life will cause people pain. And the addiction is an attempt to escape from that.
Yeah.
And because the person doesn't have the strength, or at least they don't believe they do.
Yeah.
So this is really compassionate therapy, I think.
It's like a trial to make life unreal.
That's right. That's
but there must be a greater source of optimism than just accepting the pain.
This is my moment.
I get to ask questions to Alfred Lengler and Gabor Mate. Gentlemen, what is your greatest optimism for this field?
My optimism is actually human beings. That actually we're greater than we think we are. And there's more to us than we think there is. I was in Edmonton on Saturday, and there was a big sensation in Edmonton because somebody filmed a homeless guy, a derelict, looking just awful, playing the piano beautifully. And they put this on YouTube, and this went viral. And of course, my comment was, well, if the guy had been wearing a tuxedo and a bow tie and a white shirt and a clean haircut, this would not have gone viral. It went viral because it was so surprising to people that somebody who looked like that could actually have that kind of yearning and aspiration for spiritual beauty and musical expression. Well, what was really surprising is not that a guy like that would have that in him. What was surprising is how surprised everybody was. Because we don't actually believe that people are, we mistake ourselves and other people for our appearance, our behavior, and life circumstances. And we don't get that there's something great about us all. So my optimism is in that greatness that I've seen people find in themselves despite extraordinary suffering. And that's real. That's what's actually there. And so our job is to help people find that part of themselves. And that's not easy, but it's also tremendously... it takes away all pessimism, actually, when you actually see that.
Yeah.
It just takes away all essence. Mm.
I find it so important to help people to come to experience more the values which are around, the little values. Like we are sitting here and having the immense chance to talk about addiction with all our experience and studies, and we are here with so many interested people and who want to contribute certainly and say what their experiences are. This is wonderful. Or we go out and there's a nice rain and a nice mist, and to experience with this mindful spirit what is there and to be more open to the world around us, instead of the always being fixed or focusing the inattention. Of course, when they are strong, we cannot avoid it. I understand it. That's not the problem. But the idea, the hope, you are asking for the hope,
yes,
is to look forward, to lifting up the head of the people, of our patients, that they see again the world around them, the little things in the world. Many people live in very bad circumstances, but the sun is shining everywhere in the world, and there is some wind. And some, not everybody, of course, but some people can open themselves again to this what is around and to these values which fulfill our life. And then they can come to an inner yes to what is there. And this gives a real basis. Maybe some of these patients will not step out from their addiction. We cannot help, we are not omnipotent, but maybe we can even help those people that they see at least the sun shining and the snow falling, and being there with an inner agreement, with an inner consent. This is my hope, and this is where I work to. I'm realistic, I know we can help many people in addiction, but some we cannot really help to bring them out, but that's not even necessary. I had patients who really wanted to continue in their addiction because they said, what I experienced before was worse,
yes,
and I prefer this half-numbed life. This is the best way I can deal and continue living. And this is the most important, that they can continue living in the...
And they're coming to you for what?
Common?
Why are they coming to you? What do they want?
they came to me just for, this was in a public service area, just to be connected. They came regularly, every week, every month, just of interaction.
Yeah. May I answer my own question?
Yeah.
Okay.
For me, the greatest hope is not in therapy at all. For me, the greatest hope is people who look at the, you know, fragmented world and try to restart it. People who are rebuilding culture in ways that will enable children to grow up for whom addiction is not going to be a problem. And for example, in Vancouver, I just visited the St. James Music Academy for the first time.
Right.
How many of you know about that? Can I see? Not so many. Incredible. Like this couple, without hardly any money at all, 10 years ago started a music school on the downtown east side, which every child can go to. They charge nothing. And they have excellent classical music teachers there. And when you go there, like, it's just full of music. And the children are having a wonderful time. It's all free. And every lesson, every day's lesson starts at 3 after school. Every day's lesson starts with a meal. Because the children they may not have had a meal that day. Or they may not have had a good meal that day. So it starts with a meal. And then excellent classical music instruction. And here we have children who might otherwise, you know, be going out and traumatizing each other for damn sure, who are you know, playing Beethoven on their violins and cellos, and everybody's got one. That kind of stuff is going on everywhere. And this is, of course, a spectacular example in Vancouver, but everywhere. People are looking at a dying culture and saying, how can I bring it back to life? And they're starting, you know, community gardens and every other damn thing. And it seems to me that there is the way that if we will ever see an end to the problem of addiction, it will come from there more than therapy. Even though,
sure.
I mean, therapy is absolutely essential and serves its wonderful function, but maybe there's more basis for optimism there. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. I want to turn it over to some questions from the audience. Mike, do you want to come up and we'll, what we'll do, I think, is we'll you pick some ones that a lot of people ask, I guess, and we'll alternate
sure.
And then go to the.
Yeah. So if this works, maybe one ask one of these, and if we could have people come up here and then use this microphone to ask the questions so everyone can hear. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So if you have a question that you didn't write on the card. Or you just want to make sure your card question gets answered, you can just come down here, and we'll do one from the card and one from the line. Okay, so first of all, what a privilege for all of us to be able to witness this conversation you guys are having. Thank you to all of you. The first question, maybe I'll direct towards Alfred and Gabor, and then Bruce had a couple of them for you after. But anyone can answer these. So the first question is, can someone who is addicted to something use that substance later on if they're no longer using it in order to self-soothe, fill the void? And I just want to add on to that. Of course, they can. In some places, that would be called a relapse. But in other circles, I want to add on about kind of question about moderation management, controlled drinking, and approaches that are counter to an abstinence-only perspective, and what your views are on that.
I think you are most. Okay, well, there is kind of a ideology that says once an addict, always an addict, once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic, which means that... which is kind of the AA philosophy, which is that if you have been an alcoholic, you should never touch a drop again. Now, I don't believe theoretically that's true. I know that people can transform. I think that people can develop. They can find themselves. They find that fullness. Then they don't need to be feeling themselves from the outside anymore. Then when they drink, it's not to fill an emptiness, it's just because they're having a drink with their meal. So in theory, that's true. It's also true that the brain can develop new circuitry. We know that according to new life experience. So there's no reason to assume that theoretically, once an addict, always an addict, on the one hand. On the other hand, if you're not sure, don't play with it. You know, unless you're absolute. I've known people who used to be heavy drinkers, problem drinkers, alcoholics, but who can have a drink. Because they're no longer using it for the same purpose. It doesn't have the same function in their lives anymore. On the other hand, so I think the answer is very much yes. On the other hand, if you're not sure, then you better not experiment. So better, if you're going to make a mistake, make it on the side of caution rather than the side of assumptions that you're okay. That's what I would say.
But on the other hand, I would like to add that we get more motivation for treatment in addicts when the goal is not to a full stop of all, full, how do you say?
Abstinence,
yeah, of all addictive behavior, but just to reduce it and thus to come to a better life. So for the motivational issue, it's also important to have this vision, which was not possible to have 30 years ago. It was absolute a no-go at that time.
Well, you won't find Bruce and I disagreeing. We're both involved in setting up, or at least working at the supervised injection site where people bring their drugs, and you know, so that's a whole other issue, but for sure. And even with drinkers, we know if you set up wet houses where people can live and they don't have to smuggle the drink in, but they get to drink openly, they actually drink less. Mm-hmm. Then if you forbid it for them. So there's all kinds of nuances. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And Bruce, so this question, I'm gonna read the question and answer it with a quote from you. and then ask you to elaborate. I think you appreciate that. And it's a quote from an interview you did with Tommy Rosen at the Recovery 2.0 conference in Delaware. I watched your interview, it was fantastic as well. But this quote, I'll just read the question. It's, do you believe that we as humans that are part of nature, that part of our current addictive civilization is absorbing the suffering, basically, we are putting onto nature, and I'll try to make better sense with your quote. I'm going to ask you to elaborate because I heard you say this, and it really is quite profound. You said that we mine the earth and use up our minerals and left behind depleted towns, and in the same sense, we mine our cultures and wreck them. Left behind depleted individuals who really don't have a cultural basis or a social basis for an integrated whole life. Would you be able to elaborate on that or respond to that question?
Yes, I would love to elaborate for a very long time on that. that's what's happened. I mean, we have exactly that. We exploit the environment and we exploit ourselves. And the environment and the addiction problem, therefore, are totally interrelated, inseparable. Because the exploitation of ourselves gives us, among other things, addiction. It also gives us, you know, all these other horrors that follow as well. I don't think we can separate the two. I think we have, you know, we're coming to a kind of a crescendo here where we're living in a civilization which is facing several problems at once. But let's just look at these two. These two, when we actually look at them very, very carefully, they turn out to be the same problem. They turn out to have exactly the same basis. And therefore, I think ultimately what we're talking about is, of course, social evolution, not to say revolution, but you know, we're talking about changes that must occur, and it's not like maybe they should occur; they must occur, or else the, you know, the tide is just going to keep coming right on up from Falls Creek and Burrard Inlet, and we won't even worry about the rain anymore. Yeah. I think I do believe that it's time. I believe addiction is our teacher. You know, it, for a long time we have tried to do something about addiction. We regarded it as a containable problem, but it turns out it isn't. It turns out it's interrelated with our very biggest problems, and it turns out that addiction is actually a window. It's a teacher. And I think it's not to say we don't have other teachers. I'm not saying the world spins around the axis of addiction. I don't mean that. But I just mean that it is among the important things that we have to face as a culture. Addiction is one, and we haven't really fully faced its importance yet. So those two problems come together.
Tony Rosen, by the way, has just published a book on addiction. Mm-hmm. It's called The Recovery 2, and it's really one of the best books on recovery that I've read. I happened to write the foreword for it, but that's not what makes it good. I wrote the foreword because it was good. And it's called Recovery 2. He's somebody who's been through 12 steps, and he knows them, he respects them, he also critiques them. It's just a wonderful read, and I think a very practical manual as well. I highly recommend it.
Thank you. And thanks, Bruce. I really, and as a parent, I think that quote really shook me up about the type of, you know, as I said, we feel everything's normal. There's football games on Sundays, there's all these distractions, and we feel that everything's just proceeding along in a healthy society. And that quote really kind of...
Well, as a parent, look, the Fisher-Price now has a new baby seat for one-year-olds that has a holder for an iPad on it. They're creating one-year-old addicts.
Really?
The one-year-old screen addicts, yeah. Yeah.
Got to get one for my grandson.
You got to get one for your grandson.
Sorry, the apocalypse. So, another question for you, Gabor. Kind of a couple questions along the same lines. Basically, it's about brain development, brain development, and the developmental impact of childhood sexual abuse. Can there be new neural pathways created in adulthood? And then, similar question was, how do you integrate trauma?
Well, I think the second question can go to certainly at least myself and Afid as well. The first question about brain circuitry. Well, yeah, look, I give you one brain scan result. They've done brain scans on adult women with depression. And some of them had been sexually abused, some had not been. And there were specific brain changes in the ones who'd been sexually abused as children that were not present in the ones who had not been sexually abused. In other words, that childhood experience actually shows up in a form of brain circuitry in the adult. We know also from suicide studies in Montreal that when they looked at the genetic markers in the brains of people who committed suicide, those who had an abuse history had different genetic markers. So abuse actually affects how genes function and how brain circuitry develops. I mean, we have to get with the fact that the brain is a social product. It's a psychosocial product. The brain is not just a genetically determined entity. And what happens in childhood is just, especially in the first few years, is a huge impact on the development of the brain, which circuits function, which zones, how the genes are turned on and off. That's just a scientific reality that medical practice is nowhere near catching up to yet. Nor is politics, for that matter, of course. In terms of what can happen in the adult, yes, you can develop new brain circuitry to override the old ones. So there's the psychodynamic aspects of integrating trauma that I really let Alfred speak to, because I'm sure he'll have interesting things to say about it. But just from the brain developmental point of view, yes, you can develop, in response to good therapy or good new experiences, new social experiences, you can develop brain circuits that override the old ones. And that's where the choice and the freedom comes in, is when the automatic fear response that emanates from the amygdala, which is the fear center, that overwhelms the cortex. But you can get new circuits to override that one, so that there's that space
image freedom can arise. Now, the psychodynamic aspect of integrating trauma, perhaps you'd like to speak about.
I want to add first to the,
sure.
Apart from the neurological changes, there are the genetic changes.
Yeah.
A constant stress, you already mentioned, a constant stress produces epigenetic changes which are heritable and which last at least over three generations as we know now.
Right.
So this is also a limitation for psychotherapy to a certain degree, because there are genetically induced stress reactions which will continue even when the problem is worked through, or the problem may have happened in the former generation. And so the next generation has the stress reaction, etc. So this is this unity of the human being, that we are historical beings, not only on the cultural level, but of course on the genetic level, on the neurological level, and this is this wonderful view on the human being, but which gives also the possibility to work on and to come to a different stand to oneself, to understand oneself better and other people better, and so to integrate, to ease the situations which we ultimately cannot make not happened, but we can live with what happened. And this is human life. In every human life happened a lot of bad things, but also a lot of good things, and we are integrating that all. Yeah.
Thank you.
Frameworks for understanding addiction, and I'm curious in your experience in terms of which frameworks you tend to emphasize when it comes to addictions that eventually resolve. There's one in particular I'd like to ask you to speak to. I remember coming across this one study that was examining individuals who are addicted to crack. And when they were given the choice every hour to choose a $10 certificate that they could later use for groceries and that type of thing versus a dose of crack, and they were given this choice every hour, if I recall correctly, a vast number of them kept choosing the coupon rather than the crack. And also, there was some talk about rat studies, and there was one, if I recall correctly, if rats were placed in a deprived environment with access to some kind of pleasure stimulus, they would repeatedly press it in some kind of behavior that addicts might. However, in a very rich environment, they tend to not become addicted, if we can apply that term though. And so, in terms of practical approaches to resolving addictions, can you speak to how important it is to emphasize choice creation, so to speak, in terms of if it seems like we don't have a mental framework for creating positive choices in our lives, is that something that you tend to practically emphasize in your approach?
Can I take that one on?
Yes, please.
yes. Carl Hart did the experiments with the crack, and our group up at SFU did the experiments with the rats. Carl Hart also wrote an incredible book, which everybody should read, which is called High Price, which is about his own life in the ghetto in Miami. He's a black guy who grew up in the worst of the Miami ghettos in the years of the great crack epidemic. And all three of those things, his experiments, his life, and the Rat Park experiments, I think all go to show that in various ways that choice is really never lost, but it can be severely restricted. And I actually think Carl Hart's work is the best, because he's saying that, you know, all the stuff that happened in the Miami ghetto and that was attributed to the crack epidemic really was all there before. And the people that he grew up with, including himself, he was a dealer and a user. Many of them used crack and sold it, you know, without really getting into terrible, difficult problems. So even in that worst of all possible conditions, some people were able to get through it. And he explained how, because in his particular family, his parents, you know, were murderously aggressive to each other, and but his sisters took care of him, and he kept getting basketball scholarships throughout high school, and he was saved from going down the tubes by just little things, little social things, like the fact he was a good basketball player, even though he was a short.
But wouldn't he be the exception that proves the rule?
Well, he's the exception that proves that, you know, you can make it through under those conditions. But
sure, all you need is sisters who look after you and a basketball skill. That's all you need. Then you'll make it.
No, you can't know in advance just what the formula is. There's no formula. But what you can say is that there are conditions, even under the worst. There are advantages which can appear even under the worst of conditions. But it's absolutely clear that the worst of conditions are intolerable for most people, and therefore you've got to change the worst of conditions. That's how I would put together those pieces of research.
Look, Alfred and I had this discussion last time you were here. You know, there's Viktor Frankl. Is it in Buchenwald or Dachau? Where is he? Where he's in the concentration camp, the Nazi concentration camp, experiencing and witnessing all this brutality every day.
Yeah.
But he looks out at the countryside, sees
the sunset,
the beauty of God, and he says, what a beautiful world we live in.
No, well, that's an exaggeration.
Is it exaggeration? what did he say? He said something positive. He was doing bad.
He said something positive. Yeah, he was mindful to that happening, and this helped him and his inmates to overcome the situation. Yeah. Look at that sunset. This lets them see that despite of their terrible situation, is still some beauty in the world. There is still something real.
Yes.
And they were open to that world. And this is so important to overcome difficult situations, that we keep on connected with the reality.
Sure, and that's fair enough, and it's great, and it's beautiful. But I'm saying that relatively few people in that circumstance will be able to do that. And
that's
thank God I've never been in that situation, but I very much would have thought that
my are resilient.
That my attitude would be fuck the sunset, you know. it would have made me more angry than
this
less.
This is your choice.
I know, but you say it's a choice. I'm not sure.
Choice on the basis of the one who one is.
You know what? And here's what I'm also saying, that. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, I'm pretty sure that would have been my response. What my response would be today, I'm not so sure anymore. It might very well be that, look at that beautiful thing. But that's maybe where there's the hope, is that people do evolve and that we do develop deeper connections. But in the moment, when I would have been like that, I would not have experienced the whole other choice.
Sure. And we cannot prescribe that. There is no formula, as you say, Bruce. And we need to have real respect for every single form of experience and reaction. And I understand your reaction.
Yeah.
When with the pain inside, you cannot stand to hear what even such words.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. Okay. And this is my being. And the deeper sense of freedom means that the way I am, my essence, my core self
is not touched by that.
Appears
that's
in what I do.
Exactly.
And that's my freedom. This does not mean that I can do deliberately whatever I want. It means that I am corresponding to myself. This is an existential understanding of freedom, which is maybe a bit different than...
And by the way, just to tell you, that your response to me that day, I don't know how many years ago that was, 5, 6, 7 years ago when you were here,
You remember the conversation. Mm-hmm. It was so compassionate and so understanding. It's part of the reason I'm here tonight.
Yeah. Did we answer your question?
Yeah. And this was a very free answer.
And also, bringing up Carl Hart, that's great, along with In the Realm of Hungry Ghosts, and Global Language Tradition, and Mark Lewis, Memoirs of the Divine Mind.
Right.
I think those are four books working at issues right now, that there's thinkers like this that are coming up with this stuff that's very, provides a lot of hope.
Yeah.
How we started a little bit late, so are we able to go a little bit?
Can we just finish with the term? You said before about how, like, with the addiction sometimes it's better to just, like, if you've been off of it for a while, you're on the side of caution. But let's say if you're addicted to, like, sex or work or shopping, where it's not really convenient to not ever do any of those things again in your life, then what would be, would it be a certain period of time where you'd abstain, or what kind of would be a judgment to help you there?
Well, that's not my advice, actually. See, you're not actually addicted to sex. If you're addicted to sex, the answer is very simple. And I don't mean to, I'm not facetious at all. Just marry another sex addict. No problem for the rest of your life. But it's not the sex that you're addicted to. It's the proving to yourself that you're lovable. It's the proving to yourself that you're needed, that you're validated. Now, a significant portion of the women, at least, who are so-called sex addicts, were sexually violated as kids. That's how they came to value themselves. At least somebody wants me. A significant portion of the males as well. Not all of them, but many of them. So it's not, the addiction is not actually to this behavior ever. The addiction is to the mind state that the addiction creates. It creates this high level of incentive. It creates dopamine flow in the brain. You're just in a different state of the brain and of the mind when you're engaging or you're about to engage in addictive behavior. So my advice is, don't force yourself to any kind of abstinence if that doesn't appeal to you. Don't do that. But be conscious. What am I wanting here? What am I really getting here? What do I really want here? Am I really getting what I want? If I want value, am I really getting value if somebody takes me to bed? And how much am I really enjoying it? In other words, do it, but be conscious about it. If you don't want to give up cigarettes, don't give up cigarettes. But be conscious of how you smoke. Don't light up mindlessly. Light up mindfully. And what am I looking for here? Then the experience will teach you. So in other words, I'm saying, approach your experience with consciousness and awareness and with real compassionate questions, and then the experience will teach you, rather than forcing yourself into some kind of abstinence.
I'm very moved seeing you as an existentialist.
Oh.
This is what, just a minute, this is what we really enforce, that we say, whatever you do, smoking or sex or whatever, look at, do you have an inner consent? Mm-hmm. And in confronting my experience, my doing, my acting, with the question, do I have an inner consent, this creates a new reality, and this makes me feel the harm I do to myself, to others, etc.
Well, I'm equally moved to see you become a trauma therapist.
I wanted to just mention one little thing. One of the Sexaholics Anonymous organizations, I forget which one, has in its writings the idea that we do not promote sexual anorexia.
Yeah.
And by that they mean just what has already been said. Of course, abstinence becomes ridiculous.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, so my question is a little bit more maybe political. I'm curious. British Columbia is the only province without a poverty reduction strategy. And for 10 years in a row, we've had the highest child poverty rate. And I'm curious, because you said the root of addiction is suffering, and that poverty is so linked to suffering that if you believe poverty reduction strategy or addressing poverty on a the government to address it would reduce suffering and therefore reduce addiction in the next generation, the one that we're raising today.
Well, poverty alone is not the cause of. You, like Bruce gives the example of China in his book Globalization of Addiction, where under very poverty-stricken conditions during Maoism there was no, virtually no addiction. Then you have this mad dash towards capitalism, social changes. By the way, neither of us will argue that Maoism was a higher or more beneficial form of system. That's not the point anybody's making. We're just saying that poverty by itself is not the issue. The issue is also social dislocation, a sense of control, alienation, and inequality. So poverty speaks very differently. In a country where everybody's poor, poverty means something totally different than the country where...
When it is a repressive country. Under Stalin, there was no alcoholism.
Yeah,
but, excuse me, go ahead.
Only that, in this, I think you have to look for the cause of addiction in every society, and in our society, certainly it's the inequality, the unfairness, the way that the poor are controlled and demeaned. The poor in our country, by any sort of global standards, are way richer than people anywhere else. If that means anything, but it doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything because it's not about what you absolutely have. It's what you have in relationship to what's available. It's what you have in relationship to what everybody else is doing and how much control and how much power you actually have. So in terms of governments, that's a good question, but I mean, I have a certain view of government, which is, you know, who actually is the government and who does the government actually represent and do we actually live in a democracy? You know, and my answer to that is
no, we have no hope.
That is not that there's no hope, but that we don't live in a democracy, that in other words the people don't rule and the people who do rule have a certain agenda. And poverty eradication isn't amongst their high priorities. Which is not to say that there shouldn't be political action.
So you don't think there's a link between poverty and suffering?
Oh yeah, sure there's a link between poverty and suffering.
But
as Bruce points out, it's not just suffering, it's also dislocation. And what's happened in China now is the huge dislocation. It's not just the poverty. Certainly in this country, poverty is associated with dislocation.
If I can say this, I mean, Gabor and I are on one mind on this issue, but your initial question is, you know, what about British Columbia not having a poverty reduction plan for children? Of course it should, and of course that will have some impact on addiction and other problems. It's just that we often make the mistake of thinking of addiction as a poverty problem, which it isn't. You know, it's rich people, all kinds of people have addiction problems. It's a much more universal problem, but of course we should have. I mean, it's a disgrace that we don't take care of our child poverty.
And this is not only a question of addiction, it is a question of human dignity that we help people come out from poverty.
It's awesome hearing you guys talk. It's been a real treat. So I was curious about individuals that don't establish addictions.
That don't what, sorry?
That don't get addicted to things.
Yeah.
Especially like, I'm thinking of like in rat studies where there's like some rats that you just can't get addicted to a certain drug. And yes. Just try as you might, you just can't get addicted. So I was wondering if you could comment on that. And maybe with human ties, like people who frequently recreationally use drugs, highly addictive drugs, but then don't become addicted.
Well, I mean, that's the rule, you know. Most people who use recreational drugs addictive drugs recreationally don't get addicted. It's not the exception, it's the rule. The thing which needs to be explained is that some people do get addicted. People can use all these drugs. And of course, when we're talking about addiction, you know, we're not just talking about drugs at all. So how do we explain the fact that some people don't get addicted? It seems to me, if I generalize from the cases that I've known over the years and from all the biographical stuff and all the historical stuff I read, I mean, there really is a pretty obvious correlation between the risk factors of, you know, having your life screwed up in various ways and getting addicted. But it's not perfectly predictive, and I think there has to be a little room in there for the gap between the stimulus and the response. That you know, some people somehow or other figure it out, even under the same conditions as someone else might not figure it out, and maybe the difference is as little as you know, just a tiny thing that happened that no one even noticed. So what I don't think we'll ever have a totally predictive science here. I don't think anyone is expecting that. But I think we can say that the correlations, you know, are really very clear between social dysfunction and psychological dysfunction and addiction and depression and so forth and so on.
Well, also again, addiction is not the only outcome. I mean, a Canadian study a few years ago, if you abuse as a child, your risk of cancer goes up nearly 50%. So there's other outcomes to childhood adversity. As to rats, you know, there's the famous rat study out of University of Montreal, or McGill actually, where they looked just at the maternal pup interaction in the first half an hour of life. And those rat mothers that nurtured or groomed or licked their babies more lovingly, their offspring as adults had different receptors for the stress chemicals. They could handle stress much better. And it wasn't a genetic effect, because if you put the rats who didn't groom so well, didn't treat their babies so well, and you took those pups and put them with mothers who did, and vice versa, the brain effects were still predictable in the adult. In other words, there's so many variables, but so much of it comes down to early life experience. In the case of rats, the first half an hour. My guess is that those rats who weren't groomed properly, and given that they'd be more easily stressed as adults, they would also more easily turn to substances to soothe their stress. Because that's one of the things we know, is that when people have high cortisol levels, high stress hormone levels, they're more likely to use addictive substances. So will animals. In other words, while we may not predict in the case of an individual rat, you can certainly predict that if certain events happen or don't happen, the chance of addiction goes up significantly.
So I just wanted to have one more question for the evening as we close, and I'm just wondering from each of you what really stood out for you this evening. This was such an amazing conversation and discussion to be witness to, and I'm just wondering what resonated for you most, and what are you taking home with you tonight?
I take with me a new sensibilization for the community factor, the relational factor of our civilization, of our world, which surrounds us, and that how important relationship is, relationship with others and relationship with oneself. This I take from both of you.
No, you are an existentialist.
I take home the fact that I'm an existentialist, whatever that is. You know what I take home is respect again for the utter complexity of the subject. You know, that it's just really important. It's not just that there's different points of view. That's sort of triviality that to say that. But actually, it's also how important it is to consider all those different points of view if you want to have a full understanding of this very complex phenomenon. Because it does. I mean, as Alfred said in his opening remarks, it is a very human issue. It does go to the very heart of what it is to be human beings, and to desire, and to want, and to need, and to perceive emptiness.
So there's just so many different layers to it, and I think that's what stood out for me in this conversation.
Well, my joy in life, truly, is that I have the opportunity to work with many people who are trying so hard and so seriously and with such gravity to deal with the problems that we face. And I had it again tonight. I just get a sense of joy when people are struggling hard to try, you know, to really understand. Nobody's trying to put one over here. We're all trying to really understand, and that's the most wonderful feeling in the world for me, and I thank everybody for that.
Thank you.
Yeah. My name is Thomas Sally. I'm the board chair for the Existential Analysis Society, and I get the privilege of giving a last word, which is simply one of thanks. Thank you very much for your collegiality, the discussions that we've had, and I'd like everyone to join me in thanking our facilitator, Sarah. And I have a little gift for each of you. There you are. Ooh,
cookies. Thank you.
They're not cookies. Alright.
Is this something?
There you go. Oh, you know, it's hard to know what to give as a gift on a talk for addictions. It kind of ruled a lot of things out. So I went with tea and honey and a mug from St. Paul's Hospital, who I would like to appreciate for letting us have this lecture here tonight. So anyhow, thank you everyone for joining us. Again, thank you very much for your time. We also have a number of journals on European psychotherapy with an extensive section on existentialism and therapy. A variety of articles are on sale for $20. So if this is of interest, please do sit down.
Now please, how do you spell your name?
FRIALFRIED.
IED, okay.
IED.
Curtis, he's in recovery. That's his copy of your book.
What's his name?
Curtis.
Okay.
Curtis. C-U-R-T-I-S.
Years ago. 2.0
is a personal.